The headline: Saudi forces kill at least one civilian and injure two others in an artillery shelling in the northern Yemeni province of Saada. Jordan slams Israel after the regime prevented the Arab country's envoy from entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And Australia scraps its fleet of French-made Taipan military helicopters and confirms the purchase of choppers from the U.S. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Saudi Arabia has launched another deadly attack on Yemen despite ongoing diplomatic efforts to arrange a new peace deal. Shelling by the Saudi army in Yemen's northern province of Sa'ad has left at least one dead and two others injured. We're now joined by our correspondent in Sana'a, Yusuf Maudi, to give us more details on the latest situation. Yusuf, what do you have to share with us and our viewers?
Yes, so the artillery shelling that's happening in North Yemen, in the province of Sa'ada, this is something that's happening around the clock. And, you know, on my way here to the studio, we received more breaking news of another attack, which killed more people and injured more people, including an African migrant. You know, every day we're getting these reports of continuous artillery shelling happening in the north province of Sa'ada. Every day we're getting reports of more civilians being killed by this artillery military campaign by the Saudi-led coalition in the north province of Sa'ada. Of course, as you know, the north province of Sa'ada is the Ansar Allah movement stronghold. That's where the Yemeni revolution started, and they've been bombarded the most by airstrikes since the war started in 2015. So it seems that the strategy for now by Saudi Arabia, it seems to be that although they've scaled down on their air assaults, their aerial attacks on Yemen, it seems that they have traded that for intensifying the artillery shelling that's happening in the bordering region close to Saudi borders. And in actuality, these artillery shellings are killing more people than the Saudi airstrikes themselves. And as you mentioned, this is something that's happening in the midst of continuous UN efforts to try to reach a peace resolution between the Yemeni government and the Saudi-led coalition. A couple days ago, the Omani delegation, they left the country. They failed to reach any political solution because of the conflict. And even with peace negotiations taking place for over the past 9 months, of course, in April, a ceasefire was declared and both sides, they were instructed to down their military offensive. The Saudi-led coalition has not done that. When the peace or when the ceasefire agreement was announced in April of 2022, Saudi Arabia began to intensify its artillery shelling in the province of Al-Hudaydah on the western coast, and it intensified its artillery shelling in the north province of Sa'ada. In addition to that, they've also reinforced militarily in the areas that's under their control. So if you look at the entire southern coastal line of Yemen, that's all under the occupation of UAE soldiers. If you travel from Oman to Yemen, you will find that all of the checkpoints leading up to the north is all controlled and occupied by UAE Emirati soldiers. So Yemen continues to be under occupation by the Saudi-led coalition. The Yemeni people continue to be on the receiving end of these artillery shellings that are happening in the north province of Sa'ada, and the Yemeni people are still suffering because of the strangling economic blockade, and all this happening under the UN supervision, and all this happening while the UN envoy was in the capital Sana'a. And the UN, the Yemeni people are beginning to voice their disapproval of of the strategy of trying to engage in peaceful efforts while they are the ones who are starving on the ground and while they are the ones on the receiving end of brutal artillery shelling from Saudi Arabia.
All right, thanks a lot, Yusuf Maudi, joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Elsewhere, Jordan summoned Israel's ambassador after the regime's forces prevented the Arab country's envoy from entering Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds. In a statement, the Jordanian Foreign Ministry said it handed the Israeli envoy a strongly worded letter of protest to be delivered immediately to the regime. In the letter, Jordan has underscored its official custodian status of Christian and Muslim holy places in Al-Quds, including Al-Aqsa. A ministry spokesman said Israel, as an occupying power, must adhere to its obligations under international law toward the occupied city and its sanctities. Israeli forces on Tuesday blocked the Jordanian envoy's entry to the mosque and asked him to show permission. Israel's new far-right cabinet under Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been stirring up tensions at Al-Aqsa. The regime's forces regularly assault Palestinian worshippers and help settlers storm the mosque compound. A Saudi academic is on death row for using social media as the Al Saud regime is tightening its grip on dissidents. Prominent pro-reform law professor Awad Al-Gharni was arrested in September 2017. The charges against him include owning a Twitter account and using WhatsApp to spread messages deemed hostile to the kingdom.
A prominent pro-reform law professor in Saudi Arabia is facing the death penalty for alleged crimes including having a Twitter account and using WhatsApp to share news considered hostile to the kingdom. The ruling against Awad Al-Gharni, a pro-reform law professor in Saudi Arabia, was made public in a report published by The Guardian newspaper. Gharni's son, Nasser, who fled the kingdom last year and is living in the UK, shared the details of the charges brought against his father with the British Daily. Gharni, who was arrested in September 2017, was labeled in Saudi-controlled media as a dangerous preacher, but dissidents said the 65-year-old was an important and well-regarded intellectual with a strong social media following, including 2 million Twitter followers. Public prosecutors have called for the death penalty in the case, but the court has yet to make a formal judgment. The charges against Gharni, for which he is facing the death penalty, included the law professor's admission that he used a social media account under his own name and used it at every opportunity to express his opinions. The court documents also claim that Gharni admitted participating in a WhatsApp chat and was accused of participating in videos in which he praised Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. Gharni's use of Telegram and creation of a Telegram account was also included in the allegations. Last year, Salma Al-Shahab, a Leeds PhD student and mother of two, received a 34-year sentence for having a Twitter account and for following and retweeting dissidents and activists. Another woman, Noura Al-Qahtani, was sentenced to 45 years in prison for using Twitter. The Saudi regime is also accused of ordering the 2018 brutal murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, a U.S.-Saudi citizen who used to be a vocal critic of the Saudi royalty. Khashoggi was dismembered during his visit to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. The ruling against the Saudi professor comes as human rights advocates and Saudi activists have warned that authorities in Riyadh are engaged in a severe crackdown on individuals who are perceived to be critics of the Saudi regime, as the use of social media and other communications have been criminalized inside the kingdom since the beginning of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's reign in 2017.
Awad Al-Gharni has been sentenced to death for using the social media to express his voice of dissent. That's why Riyadh and state-controlled investors have recently increased their financial stakes in American social media firms, including Twitter and Facebook. Those investments are aimed at projecting the kingdom as a hub of technology, modern infrastructure, sports, and entertainment in order to whitewash its checkered rights record.
The Saudi government and state-controlled investors have recently increased their financial stake in U.S. social media platforms, including Twitter and Facebook, and entertainment companies such as Disney. Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, a Saudi investor, is the second largest investor in Twitter after Elon Musk's takeover of the social media platform. The investor was himself detained for 83 days during a so-called anti-corruption purge in 2017. Prince Al-Waleed has acknowledged that he was released after he had reached, quote, an understanding with the kingdom that was confidential and secret between me and the government. Saudi Arabia's Sovereign Wealth Fund, the public investment fund, has separately increased its stake in Facebook and Meta, the company that owns Facebook and WhatsApp. Jit Basuni, the head of Middle East and North African advocacy at Reprieve, the human rights group, said Al-Gharni's case fits into a trend the group has observed of scholars and academics facing the death penalty for tweeting and expressing their views. Asked about the kingdom's investment in Facebook and Twitter, Basuni said, if it wasn't so sinister, it would be farcical. It's consistent with how they are operating under this crown prince. Since bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has arrested hundreds of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others for their political activism, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnation of the crackdown. Muslim scholars have been executed and women's rights campaigners have been put behind bars and tortured as freedom of expression, association, and belief continue to be denied by the kingdom's authorities. Over the past years, Riyadh has also redefined its anti-terrorism laws to target activism.
Elsewhere, Australia has confirmed the purchase of military helicopters from the United States to replace a fleet of French-made choppers, a move likely to spark frictions with Paris. Defense Minister Richard Marles says a deal has been finalized for 40 Black Hawk helicopters worth around $2 billion. The sale from U.S. arms manufacturer Lockheed Martin Corporation was signed off by the State Department in August last year. Taipan choppers, which Australia bought in 2007 from France's Airbus, have been plagued for years over maintenance issues. The announcement of replacing the fleet comes as France is set to deliver new helicopters this year. Marles has expressed confidence that the purchase of U.S. helicopters won't strain Canberra-Paris ties, but a 2021 Australian decision to ditch French-made submarines for U.S. and U.K.-made nuclear submarines sparked a bitter diplomatic row. Protesters have rallied in the French city of Marseille to protest the government's controversial pension reform plan. Protesters held torches as they marched through the streets as a sign of anger. The demonstration was called by the General Confederation of Labor Union. People want President Emmanuel Macron to halt the reform plan. France is bracing for major public transport disruptions on Thursday as workers are set to join a nationwide strike against the widely unpopular plan. The industrial action across different sectors will be the first in 12 years. The plan changes would raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. It would also increase contributions required for a full pension. Moving on, the Netherlands is planning to join the U.S. and Germany's efforts to arm Ukraine with advanced Patriot defense systems and train its forces on how to use them. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte signaled his country's intentions in a meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington. He had earlier also spoken to German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on the matter. Rutte said his government is in talks with about what exactly it can contribute to. Ukrainian soldiers are already in the U.S. to get training on the air defense system to repel Russian missile and drone attacks, the Ukraine Defense Ministry says. The training lasts 10 weeks. Russia has warned against the deployment of the Patriot system to Ukraine, saying it will be legitimate targets of the Russian military. Russia has reported a record current accounts, adding to its reserves in 2022 despite Western efforts to isolate the country. Russian Central Bank says exports and incoming payments increased by 86% to $227 billion last year compared to 2021. Moscow's trade balance also swelled to $282 billion in 2022, up from $170 billion the previous year. The bank says higher commodity prices throughout last year pushed the current account higher of fallen imports, and robust exports also kept flowing into the country. Since the war in Ukraine, Western countries, the U.S. in particular, have imposed a wide range of sanctions against Russia, targeting almost all, including oil and gas. However, Moscow sought to replace lost revenues from its energy exports to Europe with a pivot to China, India, and other Asian countries. Former EU legislator Pierre-Antonio Panzeri strikes a plea deal with Belgian prosecutors probing allegations of corruption inside the European Parliament. Qatar and Morocco are accused of bribing EU lawmakers and officials, a claim that they deny. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Former EU lawmaker Pierre Antonio Panzeri was among those arrested by Belgian police last month as part of a probe into a cash for favours scheme allegedly involving Qatar and Morocco. He has just signed a deal with prosecutors to name names in return for a reduced sentence. On Tuesday, during a debate in the European Parliament on the scandal, the EU itself was accused of corruptly targeting some of its own member states.
No peace without justice. Whose secretary has been arrested for corruption? This organization was financed by the EU, France and Germany. What a coincidence, because this very organization focused on attacking Poland.
Belgian police have recovered more than €1.5 million in cash following dozens of raids. So far, the scandal mainly involves members of the S&D political grouping in the European Parliament.
Since the accusations emerged in December, we in the Socialists and Democrats group have been working intensively to try and implement reforms to combat corruption. We have to ensure accountability, transparency and integrity.
Sitting Greek MEP Eva Kaili is among four currently behind bars awaiting trial. Lawmakers are demanding that an EU-wide ethics body is established. Aside from the Parliament scandal, each year millions of euro go unaccounted for from the EU budget. This as ordinary citizens struggle to make ends meet.
It's a serious source of concern, and we also see that there is very little progress made on poverty and social exclusion, which remains at very high level in the EU.
Some lawmakers say the EU is showing a great deal of hypocrisy, given that so much is said here about rule of law problems elsewhere. Sources tell us Belgian police will almost certainly be making more arrests in the coming days as part of the European Parliament corruption probe. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Well, the Peruvian capital is bracing for fresh protests, with people heading there from across the country to vent anger at the government of President Dina Boluarte.
We are from Chota, Cajamarca. We have come to defend our country, considering that we are under a dictatorial government, a militarist government which has stained our country with blood.
Protests are planned for Wednesday and Thursday in Lima, where a state of emergency is in place to maintain order. Peru has been gripped by deadly unrest since December, when former president Pedro Castillo was removed from office after he allegedly attempted to dissolve Congress to avoid impeachment. He is now in a pretrial detention. Boluarte assumed power shortly after Castillo's removal, but supporters of the former president keep demanding her resignation, early elections, and a new constitution. They're also calling for the release of Castillo. On Tuesday, they hit the streets again, prompting police to use tear gas canisters. Community groups and members of political parties held a counter-march wearing white T-shirts in rejection of anti-Boluarte protests. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird UTILSAT3B and IRANSATORBAT5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
During the 8-year war and aggression against Yemen, the aggressor Saudi-led coalition has completely demolished 162 health centers in Yemen and partially destroyed 375 medical centers. During this period, 66 medical personnel were martyred by direct bombing of the aggressor coalition and 70 ambulances have been destroyed. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Ansar Allah news website has covered this story and tells us more. Yemen's Ministry of Health warned of a human catastrophe that threatens the lives of more than 5,000 patients with renal failure as a result of the years-long Saudi-led blockade against the impoverished nation. Ali Jahaf, National Salvation Government's Deputy Health Minister, made the remark at a press conference in the Yemeni capital Sana'a late on Saturday, 14th of January, as he raised the alarm about the depletion of the stock of dialysis drugs and medicine for Yemeni patients suffering from chronic kidney failure. Ali Jahaf added, "This is not the first conference, and we have held more than one. We have been warning of a human catastrophe threatening the lives of thousands of dialysis patients in various governorates, but there is no response." He added, "We have addressed the United Nations and health organizations operating in Yemen that we need to provide sufficient drug stocks for dialysis sessions for the year 2023, as we need approximately 500,000 dialysis sessions every year without receiving a response despite loss of correspondence and meetings in this regard." Stressing that dialysis centers in Yemen are standing on the verge of collapse, Ali Jahaf said, "The issue will affect the lives of 5,000 patients with kidney failure who need dialysis sessions and drugs, and they may lose their lives if these solutions and medicines are not available urgently." Yemen's Deputy Health Minister underscored the importance of opening Sana'a Airport and the Yemeni port of Hodeidah, as they are vital outlets for medicine and food for millions of Yemenis in the besieged areas of the country. The Deputy Health Minister of Yemen added, "In light of the imposed blockade, we are unable as a country to import vital medicines and save our patients." Ali Jahaf went on to say, "We are in urgent need within 2 weeks to provide dialysis sessions and our stock of medicines has run out." Anis al-Asbahi, a spokesman for Yemen's Ministry of Health, also called on international organizations to urgently provide dialysis sessions so that dialysis centers in Yemen would continue to operate and save the lives of patients. Anis al-Asbahi held the United Nations responsible for saving the lives of dialysis patients and responding to the basic requirements of the Yemeni people who are currently under a Saudi-imposed siege, stressing the need to open Sana'a Airport and the Yemeni port of Hodeidah. The website of the World Health Organization, WHO, has also covered this story. Over 8 years of war and aggression in Yemen have resulted in a massive setback to an already weak healthcare system and led to a dramatic collapse of healthcare services provided to the Yemeni population. More than 20 million people out of the total population of 30 million Yemenis require healthcare services in 2023, while only half of the health facilities are fully functioning. The dialysis centers also face a severe shortfall of essential supplies such as medication and fuel to run hospital equipment, as well as a lack of funds to pay healthcare workers regularly. Via has been working as a nurse in Al-Sadaqa Hospital's dialysis center in Aden for at least 8 years. She has witnessed the torment of kidney failure patients and the decreasing capacity of the hospital to treat the patients properly. Via said, "Without dialysis, consumables and supplies, the suffering of these patients is unbearable. But because of the lack of medical supplies, we often had no other choice than to reduce the duration or the frequency of the dialysis sessions." Dr. Abdul Wahab Al-Nehmi, non-communicable disease officer at the World Health Organization country office in Yemen, said, "Limited access to dialysis sessions and treatment puts the lives of these vulnerable patients at higher risk, not to mention the suffering they go through and their families through because of the lack of medical treatment." Despite the efforts of the World Health Organization, WHO, and non-governmental organizations in coordination with health authorities in Yemen, significant gaps remain due to funding shortages and because of a lack of a humanitarian response in Yemen. Continued support is needed to save the lives of the most vulnerable people in Yemen, including patients who are suffering from renal failure. China's Xinhua news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Health officials in Yemen's capital Sana'a have warned that over 5,000 renal failure patients are at risk of death because there may not be enough essential supplies to keep local dialysis centers going. Fear and anxiety ran rampant in the renal disease ward of the Al-Thoura Hospital in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, which provided dialysis treatment for hundreds of patients every day. According to Hamdan Salamin, the hospital's deputy director, a severe shortage of medical supplies is the most pressing problem at the dialysis center in the hospital. He warned that if the center runs out of supplies, it may have to close, which is expected to happen soon. Ali Al-Ezi, one of the patients, said, "The closure of the dialysis center will be a great tragedy for the renal disease patients like him." Ali Al-Ezi complained while taking his dialysis. He said, "Life has been already very difficult in Yemen. Our salaries were cut for years and the price of medical treatment and medicine is soaring. Many of us had to sell our possessions to obtain the required medical treatments." Ali Al-Ezi said, "Now it is a matter of life and death now. If we can't get access to our treatment, we will die." Grinding into its 8th year, the Yemen war has ravaged more than half of the country's health facilities, cut off wages, reduced imports, caused serious shortages of medical supplies throughout the country, and pushed more than 20 million Yemenis to the brink of famine. The Ansar Allah movement's health authorities released a statement recently stating that hospitals in the capital Sana'a and the regions under their control will run out of medical supplies and other essential supplies for renal disease treatment by the beginning of 2023. Salamin said public hospitals are the last resort for many renal disease patients in the war-torn country because the majority of them could not afford to go to private health clinics. He added, "We call on the international community for urgent help so that we could find a solution and save the lives of thousands of Yemenis." Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies and with arms and logistics support from the United States and other Western countries, has launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015. The objective was to crush the Ansar Allah resistance movement in Yemen, which has been running the country ever since.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
In the UK, while union leaders hold a protest outside of Downing Street, MPs are debating legislation which would see striking workers in key sectors be legally required to provide a minimum service, which draws the question, is the UK trying to take away a freedom granted under Western democracy called the right to strike and the freedom of assembly? Well, strikers have said they will fight tooth and nail to protect the right to strike. In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at why the UK believes that it can prevent the right to strike in its country, yet encourage people in other countries not to go out to strike, like in the Islamic Republic, not to mention commit acts of violence. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Chris Williamson joins us. He's a former British MP and host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified from Derby, UK. Also from the UK, London, John Ross, senior fellow at Chung-Young Institute for Financial Studies, and a former advisor to London Mayor Ken Livingstone.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both, gentlemen. Let me first start with you, Chris Williamson. So what are we looking at when it comes to this bill? Because it's, ultimately it says that it's going to take away the right to strike for the people in the UK. But in what way is it going to do that once it's official and once it's passed? Because there seems to be a certain sneaky way, for lack of a better word, that the UK government is approaching this issue.
Well, I think the government, the British government, is guilty of breathtaking double standards. There's two pieces of legislation they're seeking to push through at the moment. One relates to the Freedom of Assembly, the Public Order Bill, but they're also pushing through a bill, as you mentioned in your introduction there, which will limit the right to strike for trade unions. It's the so-called strike minimum service level bill, which will limit the right to strike in various sectors like the health sector, fire and rescue service, education, transport, and border security, etc. And, you know, whilst we've got politicians kind of lecturing other countries around the world and standing up in support of protests in different parts of the globe, here in Britain, they're seeking to clamp down on the very rights which they claim to advocate. So, as I say, it is a real grotesque case of breathtaking double standards. And, you know, I don't think the trade union movement or indeed civil society is in any mood actually to accept this. And regrettably, both sides of the chamber in the House of Commons. Well, you've got the government, which are obviously pushing this legislation through, but the, you know, the opposition's position is fairly lukewarm. And so I think, you know,
why is that? I read about that. Why is the opposition lukewarm on this?
Well, I mean, we've seen a very different direction that's been taken by the Labour Party since the demise of Jeremy Corbyn after he was stepped down as leader of the Labour Party and was then suspended from the party. And the new leader, Sir Keir Starmer, and his cohorts are very much in the model, I suppose, of Tony Blair. And, you know, I mean, a lot of people see them as a pale version of the Conservative Party. So I think the way in which we'll defeat this legislation is through action on the street, through a mass movement. I don't think we can rely on the political class in the Houses of Parliament to actually do the job for us.
Sure. Let's break this down, however, a little bit here, John Ross, because we need to understand what is being passed. And one of the bills is looking at the fact that lives are at risk, if I'm correct to understand that. And it says that it was needed based on the way that it was presented by the government because we have seen in recent months a flare-up of strikes that is, in essence, putting people's lives at risk. But then you have people like the firefighters who have said, you got rid of 12,000 firefighter jobs, never mind the safety on the days that we're on strike. What about safety on every other day of the year? So you can see that there is this schism there based on this particular statement coming from the firefighters. Do you buy this legislation that's being passed?
No, this is like a schism describing the difference between a molehill and Mount Everest and saying, look, they're both got humps on them. The government has literally killed, or allowed to be killed, to be precise, much of that, thousands, tens of thousands of people through the neglect of the NHS, through its policies on COVID alone, which is responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths. And they have produced no evidence that anybody has died on any strike day, because the fact is that the strikers make sure that for the most life-threatening situations, there is cover. This talk about minimum cover is a complete fake, because the unions have never put themselves in a situation in which they're withdrawing cover in which there is life-threatening situations. And so what the unions say there is absolutely correct on this. It's not a schism at all. I mean, what it really shows is the problem the government has got. I mean, Britain's survived for, you know, hundreds of years without this legislation, this type of legislation. The reason that they're going to act now is because so many people are opposed to what they're doing. So because they're no longer facing a situation in which you've got some thousands or tens of thousands of people, they're confronting now strikes which regularly, you know, have 100,000 people involved. If you take the strike wave altogether, it involves millions of people. They're facing such big opposition, they're forced to take authoritarian measures, and they're the people who have created the responsibilities for these deaths.
All right, let me just cite a statistic. I think it's appropriate time to do that, because when we take a look at the strikes that happened last year, as an example, 417,000 working days were lost in October. Office of National Statistics said that 205,000 working days lost in September, the worst strike since 1990, and 1.1 million working days to industrial action since June. And, of course, 2023, we've seen what's happened. I figured I'd just plug that in there. So, Chris Williamson, trying to understand what the UK government is doing. Based on what I'm reading over here, is this proposed new legislation give the employers the option to fire workers and then sue trade unions? Is that one of the things that this will do in one form or another?
That's certainly the direction of travel that they're taking. And we're already seeing the fire and rehire of workers. And, you know, what the government, despite their sort of weasel words, when we saw some pretty, you know, gratuitous examples of that last year, yes, I mean, they're seeking to you know, make that even easier for employers to, I mean, literally exploit workers to an even greater extent than they already are. I mean, we've got 14.5 million people in the UK living in poverty already, and precarious employment is now endemic throughout the land. And the only way in which workers can protect themselves is by combining together and forming trade unions. And obviously what the government are seeking to do is to make it more difficult for people to, one, join a trade union, and then when, you know, unions are representing the workers to make it difficult for the unions actually to effectively represent their members. I mean, you know, the archaic way in which, you know, unions are expected to undertake a postal ballot in order to secure support for a, you know, piece of industrial action. I mean, it's absurd, particularly in the modern age when we have access to, you know, new technology, and this could be done, you know, in a much more swift and more democratic way, actually. So they're trying to put obstacles in the way, it seems to me, of organised labour, and they very clearly are working in the interests of corporate capitalism. Let's be clear about it. You know, the global corporations, that's whose side they are on. And I regret to say that, you know, the opposition is pretty much in the same ballpark as the Conservative Party are. Yes, there'll be, you know, modifications at the edges, but ultimately that's where the political class's priorities actually lie. They lie in the support for corporate capitalism, not in standing up for the interests of the people who actually elect them, the vast majority, you know, the 99%.
Sure. Well, let's look at the sectors here then, and let me play the devil's advocate, if I may, John Ross. I mean, first of all, the sectors that we're looking at here are health service, rail, education, fire, and border security, from what I'm reading here. Now, to play the devil's advocate here, some are going to say, listen, what are these strikes going to really do, aside from the fact that they're going to hurt the economy, let the government do its job, and see if they can come up with a solution, and that these strikes are not going to get anywhere. I mean, some people may be thinking that. So what would you say to those people?
Well, on the several things. Firstly, the strikes themselves are greatly influencing public opinion. The all the opinion polls show that the strikers in general have the support of the public, and in some group cases, nurses, they have absolutely overwhelming support of the public. But other groups have got support from the rail workers, etc., for example. Secondly, this is very, very necessary in order to defend people's lives. There was a very interesting article in one of the papers today noting the fact that the health situation in the country has got so bad that it's very seriously affecting the economy, because you've now got a situation in which you've got a huge increase in sickness. We already know that the workforce has fallen by about 500,000 since before COVID. That's due to all the people suffering from long COVID and the effects of COVID. And you've now got a situation where people are taking more time off from sick, etc., because they're ill. So in other words, it's having a very negative effect from the point of the economy. So the point is, it's necessary to fight back against this. The thing which I'm afraid I agree with on Chris is what the government is so unpopular now that I'm pretty sure that it's going to lose the next election. And what it's relying upon is the fact that the Labour Party won't repeal this legislation. It's verbally said it will, but they believe they won't do it in practice. And it will continue with the same policies, because these, and that will, of course, then make the next Labour government itself drastically unpopular. And so then we can have another Conservative government would do something worse. So on the contrary, these protests is the only way that people can fight back and defend the situation. And they're not acting merely in their own interests. They're acting in the interests of everybody. I mean, we've got massive shortages of workers in the health service, doctors, nurses, etc., because they've been paid too little.
Sure, indeed. Well, I'm looking at a campaign. I don't know if you've heard of it. You may have, Chris Williamson, called Enough is Enough. And
yes.
What it's saying, aside from the fact that the right to strike is under threat, it says that the new legislation will override a worker's right to withdraw their labor, forcing them to work against their will. And the important point here, one of them, is that it says it's no accident that this right is actually being under attack at the very moment that they're trying to fight back this cost of living crisis and the squeeze that they're feeling. Do you agree with that?
I very much do agree with that. And the Enough is Enough campaign has really captured the imagination of the public. I think the last time I looked, they've got nearly 1 million supporters. So, you know, clearly they've tapped into a nerve amongst the British public. People are sick and tired, frankly, of the, you know, poor conditions, you know, the high rents that people are expected to pay, the precarious employment, the lack of opportunity, the deterioration in our public services, the fact that young people are saddled with massive debts if they have the temerity to get a higher education at university, come out with, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80,000 pounds in debt, then it's difficult for them to find accommodation in which to live, rents are very expensive, almost impossible in most parts of the country for young people to get a foot on the housing ladder to buy their own home, and public housing is, you know, virtually non-existent as a result of policies that have been pursued over the last sort of four decades. But as far as the legislation is concerned in relation to trade unions, let's remember when New Labour came into power in 1997, they did make some modification to the anti-trade union legislation that had been pushed through by Margaret Thatcher and John Major's governments. But what Tony Blair was crowing about was the fact that even after the changes, modifications that they were going to make to the anti-trade union legislation, what Tony Blair said is that Britain would still have the most restrictive trade union laws in the Western world, as if that somehow was a good thing. So I think John's absolutely right that it's very unlikely that if indeed the Labour Party do win the next election, that they will do very much to actually repeal the legislation, which if indeed it does get onto the statute book, which is being pushed through right now. Look, talk is cheap. Actions speak louder than words. And the fact is that the front bench, the Labour front bench, have been banned by Sir Keir Starmer to show their solidarity, to show their support for the striking workers, the nurses, the transport workers, the postal workers. They've been banned on the
ascendancy. Unfortunately, there's a technical problem here, Chris Williamson. I'm sorry, we're getting cut off intermittently here. Let's see here. So what has the government done so far, as you see it, John Ross? I mean, they're not reaching an agreement with the striking different sectors that are striking that have government pay. They have proposed some increases, but it's not enough. And I'm going to tie that in with what this Enough is Enough campaign has said, where the government, their statement, the government is determined to force workers to pay the price for a crisis caused by the greed of the elite, yet again. Do you think that accusation is justified?
Well, certainly. I mean, all the evidence, I mean, Enough is Enough is a good campaign. There are other campaigns, well, the People's Assembly and others who are campaigning against austerity, the whole series of campaigns and trade unions on this, of which Enough is Enough is one. Yeah, but they're all, yes, they are, because all the statistics show that at the present time, the rich are getting richer. This is not just a slogan. Wealth has been greatly increased for the billionaires and millionaires. The income differentials has increased. And at the same time as literally millions of people are suffering cuts in, well, millions of people are being forced into extreme poverty. Virtually everybody outside of the top sort of, you know, few percent of the population is suffering cuts in living standards. Nevertheless, the most wealthy in the country have got better off. And the government is doing not merely precisely nothing about it. It's genuinely attempting to create such conditions. And therefore, that's why it's in a big mess. So people are striking back against this. Because it's not a case that everybody, they say everybody's in the same boat. We're not all in the same boat. And what the new thing which is getting the government is that they're hitting people who've never got any history of militancy at all. And the Royal College of Nursing hasn't had a strike for 100 years. In fact, it's the first strike in its 100-year existence. Criminal barristers have been on strike, in addition to, you know, what you might call the usual people on strike. Such as rail workers. This is touching extremely wide layers of the population, and that's why the government is so worried about it and why it's taking such authoritarian measures in the situation. It's not, they're attempting to claim this is due to some small group of extremists, but all this data that is involved and the groups of people involved show it's absolutely not. This is very wide sections of the population are completely fed up with the situation.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
And there are also different aspects of this bill that do target different movements, which is something that I think we need to talk about here. Because based on, again, what I'm reading here, Chris Williamson, groups like Black Lives Matter, Extinction Rebellion, Just Stop Oil, just to name a few, they've all, based on how they see it, have used, they call it disruptive tactics in order to bring to attention their motto or their theme, which are basically protests against the government. What's your reaction to that? I mean, are they trying to just sweep their problems under the rug for it not to be highlighted? Because after all, protests do highlight things that are worthy for the government to actually address once they see the importance of it.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, rather than actually addressing the concerns which are being articulated by the groups that you've mentioned, what the government is trying to do is to shut down those protests, to, as it were, sweep away the potential embarrassment that they cause the government by drawing attention to their failings. And certainly there is very real concern because, you know, these powers are quite draconian, you know. I mean, the right to give them to the police to stop protests in their tracks, to increase the powers of stop and search, to criminalise what they refer to as locking on, the sort of tactic that was used by the suffragettes, well over 100 years ago to secure votes for women. These sort of activities will be criminalised. And there is a real fear. I mean, already black people are targeted and are subject to sort of draconian powers that the police already have at their disposal in terms of stop and search. And this is going to increase. And I think black people, an Asian community in Britain, are likely to be targeted to an even greater extent. So it's really crucial, you know, that we do build this mass protest, this mass opposition to what the government is doing, and really force political change, force the Labour Party, frankly, you know, to speak up and actually do what they are supposed to do. And that is, you know, to kind of, as it were, represent the sort of progressive interest in this country. It's a tragedy, frankly, that, you know, the direction the Labour Party has taken of late. And that's why it's encouraging to see movements like Enough is Enough and other protest movements really, you know, stepping up and taking to the streets in the numbers that we've not seen in this country for decades.
Yes, and that's going to continue from the looks of it, at least until now, unless a solution comes up. But that remains to be seen. Since almost ran out of time, my final question goes to you, John Ross. It's very hard to take a look at the UK government passing legislation to the degree that we just spoke about, and yet at the same time encourage protests in other countries, and in particular, obviously I'm referring to, in this case, in point, the Islamic Republic. I mean, you can't have a TV station that you're funding and ask them to encourage protesters to come out, not only incite violence, but also host other TV stations like a Saudi-funded one, of which they're more extreme, of which we call it a terrorist media station, to do the same, if not to some degrees even harsher. Is that a valid assessment to make on this?
Well, yeah, to understand the so-called free speech in the West, you have to understand what is the situation. If you're discussing something which really doesn't matter very much, or you're tiny, that is, you don't influence the situation, or you're discussing something which is not very important, then you can have free speech. If you're either you have very powerful positions, or you're discussing something which is extremely important, then you get the clamp down on free speech. That's always been the rule. If you want to have a big discussion in Britain, should we drive on the left-hand side or the right-hand side of the road? I'm sure it won't be interfered with by the state because it won't affect anything very much except in practical terms. If you want to discuss wars or you want to discuss, you defend your standard of living, then yeah, then the free speech will be clamped down upon. That's always been the case and it remains the case. It's why there isn't real free speech in the West at all.
All right, thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Let me thank our guest, Chris Williamson, former British MP and host of Press TV's Palestine Declassified. Do check it out. PressTV.ir is our address for that one. And John Ross, a senior fellow at Chungyang Institute for Financial Studies and former advisor to London Mayor Ken Livingston. Thank you for your input. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tapway and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From our Imams, the ninth Imam is the first, whose Imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, and he was the ninth divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was brought up in the house of Nubuwa, Prophethood, and Imamat, a house by which Allah had honored the Muslims all across the world. And so Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam grew up in the shade of that honored and noble house, while he received high ideals, morals, values, knowledge, and wisdom from his father, the eighth divinely appointed Imam, who shed rays of light from his great soul unto Imam al-Jawad. Imam al-Jawad's father, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, himself had undertaken the upbringing, the nurturing, the education of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. And so we find that Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam